Hello, and welcome to the Novel Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast with two siblings who love books.
We sure do.
I'm sitting on a throne made of books right now.
It's kind of obscene how you guys like books. I feel a little uncomfortable yet aroused.
Too much book loving going on around this table.
Sometimes I just pick up my books at night and rub them against my cheek.
You're taking bibliophile to a new level.
Inappropriate.
So anyway, I'm Ben.
I'm Gabs.
And this is part two of our Merchant of Venice podcast.
And we are once again joined by our good friend, Dr. Anthony Funari.
Indeed. And we're going to skip the spoiler alert. You know how it works.
Yeah. Plus... I mean, we talked about this last week, so...
Yeah, and so since part two is actually getting recorded the same day as part one, we're not going to have any reader response this week.
Bam!
So instead, wow. We're going to read a selection from the trial scene of the play, because that's more or less what we're going to be talking about.
A lot about Shylock, a lot about the trial scene, and we kind of wanted to try our hands at performing a little bit, just to see if listening was easier than reading.
Yeah, also this is a... little bit of a cold read in some senses, so be prepared for that. Anyhow, here's the casting for this section for those of you who don't have a copy of the script handy, though you can go find one online if you want.
Yeah, really easily. I will be, Gabs will be playing Portia because I'm a girl.
I will be playing Shylock because I know he's a Jew now. I'm the most educated about
him. Oh, Lord.
I will be playing everybody else because I'm just versatile.
Yes, so give us your Bassanio voice.
Oh, you're so versatile.
Oh, jeez.
Damn it. Okay, give us your Gratiano voice.
Bro, dude.
Close enough?
I'm thinking Gratiano more as like a Keanu Reeves.
Do it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Dude.
And he will also be Nerissa when she's in there.
A higher pitch your voice.
I guess I can't really do a high pitch for it.
Don't try to sound like a caricature of a woman. Just
just sound like a woman.
Wow, I could get in real trouble for that if I really
no. Just squeeze your balls a little.
Just okay, sound, just sound like your wife, Tony.
Oh, this could be fun.
Oh boy!
All right, so if Kim anyway. Creeps into the podcast, that's Nerissa.
So we're starting right before. Portia has entered the scene cross-dressed as a young doctor, so she's masquerading as a man, which I don't know why people fall for it, and she's just about to deliver her judgment on whether or not Shylock deserves his pound of flesh.
Should I start?
Yeah, start with Bassanio.
All right. Antonio, I am married to a wife, which is as dear to me as life itself, but life itself, my wife, and all the world are not with me esteemed above thy life. I would lose all, sacrifice them all here to this devil to deliver you.
Your wife would give you little thanks for that, if she were by, to hear you make the offer.
I have a wife.
Keanu Gratiano.
I have a wife who I protest I love, and I would she were in heaven so she could entreat some power to change this cursed Jew. 'Tis well you would offer it behind her back. The wish would make else a unquiet house.
These be the Christian husbands. I have a daughter. Would any of the stock of Barabbas have been her husband rather than a Christian? We trifle time. I pray thee, pursue sentence.
A pound of that same merchant's flesh is thine. The court awards it, and the law doth give it.
Most rightful judge.
And you must cut this flesh from off his breast. The law allows it, and the court awards it.
Most learned judge, a sentence, come, prepare.
Tarry a little, there is something else. This bond doth give thee here no jot of blood. The words expressly are, a pound of flesh. Take then thy bond, take thou thy pound of flesh. But, in the cutting of it, if thou dost shed one drop of Christian blood, thy lands and goods are, by the laws of Venice, confiscate unto the state of Venice.
Oh, upright judge, mock Jew, a learned judge.
Is that the law?
Thyself shalt see the act, for as thou urgest justice, be assured thou shalt have justice, more than thou desirest.
Oh, learned judge, mock Jew, a learned judge.
I take this offer then, pay the bond thrice, and let the Christian go.
Here is the money.
Soft. The Jew shall have all justice. Soft, no haste. He shall have nothing but the penalty.
O Jew, an upright judge, a learned judge.
Therefore prepare thee to cut off the flesh. Shed thou no blood, nor cut thou less nor more, but just a pound of flesh. If thou cutst more or less than just a pound, be it but so much as makes it light or heavy in the substance, or the division of the 20th part of one poor scruple. Nay, if the scale do turn but in the estimation of a hair, thou diest, and all thy goods are confiscate.
A second Daniel, a Daniel Jew! Now, infidel, I have you on the hip.
Why doth the Jew pause? Take thy forfeiture.
Give me my principal and let me go.
I have it ready for thee. Here it is.
He hath refused it in the open court. He shall have merely justice and his bond.
A Daniel still, I say, a second Daniel. I thank thee, Jew, for teaching me that word.
Shall I not have barely my principal?
Thou shalt have nothing but the forfeiture, to be so taken at thy peril, Jew.
Why, then the devil give him good of it. I'll stay no longer question.
Tarry, Jew. The law hath yet another hold on you. It is enacted in the laws of Venice, if it be proved against an alien, that by direct or indirect attempts he seek the life of any citizen, the party against the which he doth contrive shall seize one half his goods. The other half comes to the privy coffer of the state, and the offender's life lies in the mercy of the Duke only, against all other voice. In which predicament, I say, thou standst. For it appears, by manifest proceeding, that indirectly and directly too, thou hast contrived against the very life of the defendant, and thou hast incurred the danger formerly by me rehearsed. Down, therefore, and beg mercy of the Duke.
Shylock, pwned.
Okay, that's where the scene ended.
No, Shakespeare actually wrote Shylock, pwned.
It's totally in there.
Okay, just gotta move the letters around.
Yeah, so in that scene, Shylock has been demanding the entire time that he get his pound of flesh, because that's what the bond says. The bond says he gets his pound of flesh. And so Portia takes it a step further and says, all right, if you're going to, you know, adhere to the semantics and the exact letter of the law, then the exact letter of the law says just a pound of flesh.
No blood.
And if it's a little more or a little less...
You're dead.
You've broken the law.
It's a little less, couldn't you slice off another little piece?
So, yeah, and then at the end she says, yep, and now we're going to take all your money away.
Well, and the legal standing is that, again, being Jewish, he is alien. He's not actually a citizen of Venice.
Right, because she actually calls him in that speech an alien.
Yeah, and so, it's not blood, it's Christian blood.
Right, which kind of harkens back to Shylock's very famous speech where he says, if you prick us, do we not bleed? You know, saying we all have the same blood. And again, at the end here, it's remarked, no, Christian blood is different than Jewish blood.
According to the Christians.
Yeah, according to the Christians.
Right.
And I think you can argue to some degree that maybe Shylock deserves not to get the money a little bit, just because he was kind of being so, no, I won't take the money. And then he's finally like, okay, I'll take the money. And Portia's like, nope.
Well, she beats him at his own game. This idea, right. I'm taking the strict literal definition of the law says and what the bond says. So,
yeah, and finally he's at the point of, I really just want the principal back.
Right. Yeah, can I just go? And I mean, Portia saves Antonio from getting killed. But you notice how eager Bassanio is. He's like, here's the money. Yeah, yeah, take it and go. I don't care. Mm-hmm. And she's like, no, no. Gotta humiliate him first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let him feel it. Although you can argue the reason he was being so adamant is because the Christians have been pretty horrible to him in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, it's clearly a matter of revenge.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, and also partly sparked on by Lorenzo running away with his daughter. I mean, that's a lot of what drives it.
Yeah, it's the final indignity.
Yeah, exactly.
Antonio kind of, by having been a business... not really even business rival, because it's not like Antonio is profiting from lending people money interest-free, but someone who's been hurting his business and who has been kind of a jerk to him, just in general, like on a personal level, and probably just living in a society where people spit at him and go, Jew, all the time.
Yeah.
I could get fed up with that. Who wouldn't be pissed off? And here's a symbolic revenge for you against all Christians by cutting out a pound of flesh of this wealthy merchant a-hole's flesh.
And I do like the scene where he says, "Didn't you call me a dog last week? Well, you know, if you poke a dog, if you kick a dog, aren't they going to bite you back? Well, you just kicked me, so I'm going to do what you expect me to do because you think I'm a dog."
Yep.
I'm not taking the higher road, so there's a lot to be said for that.
This is why Shylock is probably the sympathetic character to a modern audience. Because he, and, you know, the famous, "If you prick me, do I not bleed? If you poison me,
do I not die?
Yeah.
And if you wrong me, shall I not take revenge? If I am like you in this, I will be like you in the rest."
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well,
and we read that as, hey, I'm just as human as the rest of you. And why are you picking on me just because I'm Jewish and because I lend money? Which, by the way, isn't really even my idea.
Yeah, Tony, why don't you tell us a little bit about the state of Jews in the Renaissance and this whole lending money business so people can stop being like, what's the deal?
Well, most likely Shakespeare never met someone who was openly Jewish. In 1290, the Jews were actually expelled from England by the great Edward I. If you remember, saw Braveheart, that was the king. And among his many dick moves was he also expelled the Jews from England. So
what are you talking about?
Yeah.
It was great.
Yeah, right.
And his son was just gay, so whatever.
And then really what we see happening a lot in England is these terrible stories about Jews. They become these highly fictionalized villains that are really portrayed as inhuman. I mean, if you ever read, like, the Canterbury Tales, the Prioress's Tale, which was a tale of, I believe it's, of a group of Jews killing a young Christian boy for his blood, essentially.
Of course.
Yes, because, and that Jews become very much associated with that in the Christian mythology. Okay. So then what we have, the only real community that maybe Shakespeare might have gotten to know in England at the time was there was a group of conversos, Spanish and Portuguese Jews who were living in London at that time. And actually,
they were masquerading as Christians though, right?
Well, no, they had converted because of the Spanish Inquisition. Yeah, so
they were not really.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, as much as, you know, forced conversion is really a thing.
Right. Believe in this or we kill you.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Pork? I always wanted to try that.
Christianity rules. Let's all go eat bacon.
It's happening.
Yeah. Actually, it was kind of interesting. One of Elizabeth I's physicians was a Spanish converso.
Yeah.
Dr. Rodrigo Lopez, who was pretty much falsely accused of poisoning her.
Mm-hmm.
And he was put to death because of it. And, you know, so that's probably the only real exposure that Shakespeare actually had to the Jew, to a Jewish community.
Mm-hmm.
So, but there was always these sort of stock characters, or caricatures of Jews, and they're associated with usury. One of the reasons is because they could not have any other profession. They couldn't become members of the guild, there was no other way for them to make money, so they, you know,
and
were users.
What is usury?
Usury is basically capitalism. It's when you lend money at an interest rate. This was kind of something that was very, very much looked down upon for a variety of reasons. One is because what you were doing there essentially was breeding gold. You were taking a certain quantity of gold, the principal, and having it breed itself without actually doing anything.
Right.
And actually, it's kind of interesting. Shakespeare's father was once accused of usury. He was brought to trial for it.
Yeah, I think I've heard that. Ben and I are having a conversation last night about lending things on interest and saying, well, we certainly went away from the idea that was a moral sin.
Yeah, exactly.
That's how most of America works.
Consumerism on the private and actually any business level, like, just everything is done on credit. And right. Everybody's taking a percentage, and that's mm-hmm. where a lot of the money comes from.
Yeah.
And everyone's in debt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, Shylock has won, ultimately. I mean, yeah, and a lot of what we see in the play is this sort of transition between, you know, a feudal world to a capitalist world. I mean, Venice is a capitalist society, and Belmont is a feudal society. And,
I see that.
Yeah, and a lot of the... And this was a time when we start seeing this move from feudalism to capitalism, you know, during the Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
So this play is very much addressing those cultural and economic concerns.
And that's why everyone hates Shylock.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, he's...
Yeah.
He's a force of change a little bit. People are always afraid of new things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's kind of funny in a sort of horrifying way, I guess. The, Jews are all greedy because they lend money out on interest, but it's because we force them to.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
The Jews are like, seriously, guys?
Mm-hmm.
Like, we can't do anything else.
Yeah, hey, Jews, the only job you're allowed to have is lending money because
mm-hmm.
we need people to do that.
Right.
And... we look down on you, Jews. All you do is loan money and charge interest,
you
greedy bastard.
Yeah.
You made us do it!
Exactly, right.
You are dicks, Christians!
Seriously. I mean, it's
so
horrible.
When you say the reason, I just kind of popped into my head while you were talking. The reason the play's set in Venice, then, is because England had basically kicked out the Jewish population.
Mm-hmm.
So is it... just kind of a matter of logistics that, there's actually a Jewish population in Venice, so
it could
we'll
be.
Set the play there.
It could be also, you know, the idea of being Italian, being set in Italy, was it very exotic, and Italy being the center of the Renaissance, so that was a really big thing. It's sort of like, you know, let's set something in New York City today.
Uh-huh.
It was the location.
We're coming to you from the Empire State Building.
Right. Yeah, exactly. We're going to set this play in Venice, because mm-hmm. Venice is hipper than shit.
Yeah, right, that's exactly it. And also, it was a place where, you know, this area of trade. It was an area of commerce.
Yeah, it was kind of a center of culture to some degree.
Right, exactly.
I know from a really long and boring paper I wrote on music publishing in the Renaissance that Venice was kind of the center of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, that's where it's easiest to distribute stuff.
Right, exactly, exactly.
And every time a bout of plague hit the city, the whole Renaissance economy in Europe took a hit.
Mm-hmm.
Which, unfortunately, was frequently.
Yeah.
It was kind of frequent everywhere.
Yeah, and so, it's kind of interesting, you know, we talk about, you know, this idea of commerce, you know, Italy being the center of it. And like you're pointing out here, it was also center of where a lot of diseases started to spread throughout Europe, particularly syphilis.
Yeah,
I mean, syphilis
was
first introduced to Italy, so... In France, they called syphilis the Italian disease, and then in England, they called syphilis the French disease.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Shakespeare likes throwing in a lot of digs about how French guys are all...
bald.
Have STDs.
Well. Yeah, they're bald because they're STDs.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's kind of where this idea of the stock Jewish character comes from, or what Shakespeare's drawing on.
Right, but to us, or to me at least... Shylock doesn't feel very stock.
No, he really doesn't. Like, he doesn't come across as a cardboard cutout. He's like, here's a villain. Because
yeah.
he's a Jew, so he's a villain. He's clearly supposed to be villainous, because
mm-hmm.
the play wants you to sympathize with Antonio.
Right.
Which frankly, I don't. But Shylock has feelings, and he has legitimate motivations,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, he probably takes it a step farther than I would, but I would be pissed off if I was in his shoes.
Right, I mean, absolutely. I mean, a lot of the play that this the other play that this is The Merchant of Venice is often compared to is Christopher Marlowe's The Jew of Malta, and in The Jew of Malta, we get Barabbas, who is this incredible stock caricature of the Jew. He's a villain because he's Jewish, in other
mm-hmm.
words. That's
right.
Where his motivation comes from. And he does these, you know, these hyperbolic acts of villainy. He poisons a nunnery.
which is
hilarious.
Hilarious.
He what else does he do? He sets two he promises his daughter to two different guys just so he can have them fight it out and kill each other in front of him. I mean, he poisons a bunch of people by having them smell a rose.
He's glorious.
Yeah, he really is. And in the end, he was going to try to trick this invading group of Moors into a cauldron, and he's actually tricked into it. So his last dying soliloquy is him being boiled alive in a cauldron.
I'm sure he's still a magnificent bastard.
Oh, yes.
While he does it.
Oh, yes, he is.
The thing, and I mean, again, I haven't done tons of research. I've done some reading. The Jew of Malta was really popular, right?
Oh, yeah.
People loved that play.
Yes, absolutely. Because it was this sort of comedy almost.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, look at this evil Jew killing people.
Ha!
It's hilarious.
He's going to get his comeuppance.
And that play, was that play published before?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. This was put on before.
So some degree, so there's probably some influence there.
Oh, yeah. Shakespeare's
saying,
very much
we'll take
bro.
This Jewish villain because that's popular. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. That'll put butts in seats.
Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, that's a thing Elizabethan playwrights did is constantly go, oh, that idea's good.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to take it.
Yeah, the borrowing between each other.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
You see that everywhere. So
absolutely.
You see that in all of the arts during all
yes.
time periods.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. If you're going to be perfectly honest
well,
about it.
Well, I mean, the playwrights knew each other.
Right.
They bounced ideas off each other. So
Marlowe and Shakespeare were like, what up, bro?
Right.
He's like, hey, I want to write Barabbas, except he's less of a dick. Marlowe's like, well, that's not as funny, but okay.
Right. And that's the thing. I mean, what we get in Merchant of Venice, the Jew has feelings. He has motivation for what he's doing.
Right, because he's not just evil because he's Jewish. Like, you know, the first thing he says is, you guys have...
Right.
Screwed me over a lot.
Yeah, he's not even evil. He's angry
yeah.
because people have mistreated him for being Jewish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And maybe in the past he was a dick to them, but it kind of sounds like, in this case, the balance of power is so mismatched.
He's basically been bullied his whole life.
Right.
Yeah.
It would kind of be one of those things if you went to the South 100 years ago and... this black guy walked up to a white man who'd never directly insulted him before and said, you know, I don't like you. Mm-hmm. Like, well, that was out of nowhere, but if you really think about it, well...
No.
No.
No,
it's really not.
Right.
Because that guy has been screwed over by most of society for his entire life, so...
Right.
It's a pretty good reason to be angry.
Yeah, I mean, even with Shylock, he's... And I always... My favorite part in the play is when Shylock's in the court at the Court of Venice, and he actually points out... Hey, you think this is wrong? You have slaves here. Do you see this?
There
this
you go.
This is this incredible hypocrisy that you have. Well, if you, you know, if you deny me this, why don't you just set your slaves free? Let them marry your daughters.
Yeah, he does. And you would answer, the slaves are ours.
Yes.
Well, that pound of flesh is mine. So.
Mm-hmm. So fork it over.
Yeah. That's a fair point.
Mm-hmm.
And also, so that's probably why Shylock is the interesting character to a modern audience. But Tony, you were saying something interesting before we started recording earlier mm-hmm. about how an Elizabethan audience probably would have perceived that if you
yeah.
prick me, do I not bleed speech? And some of the other things he said, basically where he's trying to claim that he's as human as everyone else.
Right. They would have been repulsed by that idea. Because, no, he is marked as other. This idea of appeal to universal humanity, that's something that resonates with us because, you know, that we're living in, you know, a pluralist society. We're living where, you know, we value equality. We do try to do away with our prejudices. And we're living in a post-Holocaust society, too. So when he talks about, the, you know, this appeal to universal humanity, okay, yes, we agree with that. I can hear that. I understand that. I sympathize with that. Elizabethan audience, hells no. My God. No, are you crazy? How dare you think that we have to share the same blood? No.
So they'd probably just be like hissing through that.
Right, exactly. They would have been repulsed by it entirely.
Right, so after the play, instead of being like, man, that guy, you know, just pointing out how he's like us and he got screwed, they'd be like, man, I can't believe Jews think they're like Christians.
Right, exactly.
So what do you think Shakespeare was doing by writing the character that way?
You know, it's so hard to say.
Because we don't...
You can't judge his intent. We don't anything he's written about it, as far as I know.
I feel like it's hard to look at the play and look at Barabbas and look at Shylock and say Shakespeare wasn't trying to do something. I mean, maybe he was just trying to make the character more, you know, dramatic, according to theater, saying, like, I just want a fleshed out character, but he's still going to be a bad guy.
Right.
And then the fact that he gave him motivation ended up making him sympathetic.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we have the same thing with Macbeth, right? I mean, here's a character who commits the ultimate sin. He kills a king and then usurps his throne. I mean, this is a horrible, but we can't just dismiss him and say, oh, you're just a horrible person, a villain. There's a lot of humanity to him too. And the audience does sympathize with him. And I think that's one of the keys, one of the great things about Shakespeare, and not to sound too Shakespeare.
He's the best. I love him.
Screw everybody else. There's nothing but Shakespeare. No. But he does give he gives a sense of individuality. He gives a sense of introspection to his characters. And what he does, he also often pits the audience's sympathies against their better judgment. So
yeah, well, when authors, playwrights, screenwriters, whatever, are creating villainous characters, they so rarely do bother to flesh them out. A lot of times they're evil just for the sake of being evil.
Mm-hmm.
And there's actually one of the Lazarus Long sayings from Robert Heinlein's books is that when you're facing an enemy, think about what his motivations and his self-interest are, because nobody is actually a villain just for the sake of being a bad guy.
Right.
Like, they're coming from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's interesting that Shakespeare would write a character who is clearly supposed to be the villain, but then give him some of those motivations. Mm-hmm. Because Barabbas clearly didn't need them.
Right, no. Exactly.
He was just a gloriously evil Jew.
I'm Jew, so I'm a villain. Ha, ha, ha.
I'm now going to poison nuns.
Yeah.
They probably deserve it.
Yeah.
I was reading the way The Merchant of Venice has been produced through time, and it was talking about various portrayals of Shylock and how, I guess, the stereotype for the Jew is the red hair, they would wear, like, a red wig and, like, a nose or something, and just be completely over the top with Shylock.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But then how it's definitely developed into a much more subdued...
mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Al Pacino, I think...
Mm-hmm.
Just gives such an incredibly sympathetic portrayal and is so just powerful when we see him. We actually see it scene that we never actually get in the play of him just wandering around screaming, "My duck, it's my daughter." And whereas in the play, it's supposed to come off as this sort of comedic moment, ha ha ha, duck, it's daughter.
Oh, the Jew can't decide between his love of money and the love of his offspring.
Yeah, these typical Jew. No, but in the film, we actually see Pacino portraying this moment, and it's so sad. I mean, he's just wondering. He's just crushed because he's lost his daughter and his money.
Yeah, it's not like, oh, no, my money means as much to me as my daughter. But I think one of the things he says in the trial scene when they say, "We're going to take all your money," and he's like, "Well, you know, if you're taking away my money, you're taking away my home.
Mm-hmm.
And if I don't have a house to shelter me, then what do I have?"
Right.
Kind of making this point of, I don't just like money for money's sake.
Right, exactly.
Everyone needs a livelihood, guys.
Yeah. So.
And one of the things, at the end of the trial scene, one of the ways you can kind of perform Shylock's lines is once they've taken the wind out of his sails, now they're going to force him to convert.
Mm.
And he says, "I can't sign it here. I don't feel well. Mm. I have to go home." And if you say those lines right, it's basically like, wow, that guy just realized that the rest of his life is going to suck.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm crushed and realization is setting in about that.
Mm-hmm.
And then he leaves and all the Christians are gloating about it. Gratiano's like, "Man, I would have killed him." Like,
yeah.
Thank you, Gratiano.
Thanks, bro.
No, Gratiano, that might have been the kinder course of action. You could make that argument.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
A reasonably thorough treatment of Shylock. What other moral issues are we facing here?
Oh, well, we touched on the feminist issue, but we haven't really gone in depth about the difference between men and women in the play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, well, let's see. Men are able to wander about freely, whereas women have to cross-dress to leave the house, apparently.
At least, yeah, in the world of Venice, they have to.
Because mm-hmm. if you ever see a woman, well, there are women at Belmont, mm-hmm. and then you have Jessica still dressed as a woman in Venice in one scene when she's in her house.
Right, but she can only...
But yeah, anytime they're out on the street or in mm-hmm. the court, they're dressed as dudes.
Yeah, well, it's because Venice is a world, a manly world.
Mm-hmm.
It's the world of men. It's the world of commerce. Mm-hmm.
So they just never leave the house?
Well,
I mean, it, maybe.
It might, yeah, it might very well be. I mean, we don't, at least in the world of the play, the way the play portrays the world of Venice,
right.
they don't. Okay, it's, we only see male characters interacting with each other. Or women dressed up as men.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And the women all interact and have all their power in their games
mm-hmm.
at Belmont, which is kind of the fantasy realm.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. And even then, you have that hint of patriarchy like we talked about in the last episode with Portia and the caskets and her dad still controlling what she can do with her mm-hmm. life.
Right, he's dead and he's still controlling her destiny.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I always saw another interesting comparison between the two worlds. It's kind of along the lines of gender here. We see that, okay, in Venice, what breeds is money. Gold breeds gold, right? It's like this unnatural form of breeding. In Belmont, we actually get people are breeding. I believe it's Graziano tells Bassanio, I'll race you to see who will have the first son. So we get this sense, okay, this is a world that, you know, we have people are breeding. You know, it's more about heterosexual coupling. And in Venice, it's all about money breeding itself.
Mm-hmm.
And this is only the world of men.
Okay.
And I think it, and even that comes into that tension over the ring.
The ring.
The
plot line that Ben could not care less about.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's
talk about that ring plot.
Yeah. Unnecessary things
mm-hmm.
that should have been cut.
So Portia, as the young lawyer, decides. Well, I just told Bassanio that if he got rid of that ring, I would, you know, give him what for. So now, dressed as, like, a young lawyer, she does her best to just...
She talks him out of the ring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is, I always thought was a dick move.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah.
Dude.
And the nurse is like, that sounds fun. Let me go get mine from Graziano.
Yeah, if we're dicking over our husbands, let me play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then in the next... And then basically Act 5 revolves around... How dare you give away our rings? You're sleeping with other women. What is wrong with you?
And oh, well, the lawyer has the ring. Maybe I'll sleep with him instead.
Right. And Nerissa makes some comment about... he'll grow hair... He won't until he grows hairs on his chin or something.
Right, yeah.
Like, oh, I'm never going to grow a beard. And then he's like, no, he'll grow into a man. And she's like, only if a man grows into a woman. Like, dropping all these hints, and at the end they're like, oh, we have your rings.
Oh. And they both very comically go, oh, now I get it.
Well, you guys were there, and we didn't notice it was you.
Those lawyers sure looked like women. You women sure seem to know a lot about those lawyers. It's weird. There's probably no connection there.
Like we said, that's why Jessica wasn't part of it, because Lorenzo was just smart enough to be like, wait
right.
a minute.
Just barely ahead of the curve.
I think that could be a woman.
Lorenzo, brain trust of the merchants of Venice.
That's not saying much.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, Portia's clearly smarter than all of them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that is another, like, one of the feminist issues that you can talk about Shakespeare's plays is he has... bold, strong, interesting female characters.
He really does. I mean, it's hard to say, dismiss Shakespeare as just being incredibly sexist. I mean...
So is that a thing that other playwrights did in that time at all? Like, was it a comedy trope to, hey, look at these women outsmarting men. What a bunch of dumb men. Isn't that funny? Like, was that the thrust of it?
You know, I'll be honest with you, that was more Shakespeare. You know, you don't get too many real romantic comedies where it's the women are as powerful, as intelligent, and bring about the resolution of the play.
Yeah, and even even taking into account the plays were written 500 years ago, mm-hmm. so a strong female character 500 years ago might not be the same as today, but a lot of the female characters in Shakespeare's plays across all the mm-hmm. different genres are more interesting than a lot of women you find in modern day Hollywood.
Yes.
Not that that's too difficult to achieve.
No, not at all.
Which is an indictment of modern day Hollywood, for sure. Mm-hmm.
But it is kind of interesting to, you know, read a play where Portia has all the money, mm-hmm. tricks everyone to do
right.
exactly what she wants, and at the end, she wins.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a woman and doing all this manipulation
right.
in a man's world.
Mm-hmm. I mean, she's running her estate in between before getting married. She's the one in charge of it. Which is, you know, well, hey.
And even though she tells Bassanio what's hers is his, you can pretty much guess in the future
yeah.
she's gonna be in charge.
Well, look at how she manipulates this chump. She's
yeah,
clearly wearing,
exactly.
She's clearly wearing the pants in this family.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, I just want... The reason I wanted to get married to Bassanio wasn't because I love him. It's because
yeah,
I can make him do whatever.
Easily manipulated.
Oh, you're going out again tonight with the boys. Really?
No, 30,000 ducats to make you feel better so you're tolerable. Oh, psh, I can do that.
Yeah,
no problem. How much money does this woman have? It's awesome.
Now I plan on wearing the pants.
And that's the case in a lot of stuff. The example that always pops into my head is Lady Macbeth
mm-hmm.
basically overpowering her husband, and that's an awesome character that tons of people want to play.
Right.
And you wouldn't think that you would find so much. I mean, I wrote a play, three female characters, and it turns out that one of them has to be played by a guy in the upcoming production because only two women showed up to audition.
Ooh,
really?
Yeah, I was like, seriously? Jeez, that's bad.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, I will give Shakespeare total props for his smart, capable female characters, and he usually has a couple of them.
Yeah, he really does. Yeah, it's not just one is the exception to the rule, and all the other women are. Yeah. But no, there's actually a really good distribution here. They're usually the smarter, intelligent characters. Figures.
Shakespeare knew some smart and acerbic women.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's because there was a queen in power.
And Elizabeth was a pretty big badass. She was pretty...
Yeah.
Head bitch in charge, man.
Oh, yeah. You kind of see it towards the end, you know, or when during James I's reign. There's not so many stronger female protagonists or characters in his plays. Like, you know, this is where we get Lady Macbeth, or in the Winter's Tale, or The Tempest. These aren't
mm-hmm.
really strong female characters anymore. So it might be very reflective of, okay, changing of the times.
Mm-hmm.
Changing of the monarch.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
And James is like, I don't want to watch plays about stinky women.
I'm like Ralph in Lord of the Flies. Except I'm a king.
And when James the First rose to power, Shakespeare's troop became the king's men.
Right.
So they were performing for the king, sponsored by the king. That's why, you know, oh, the king wrote a book on witch hunting. Guess I'll write a play with witches in it.
Yes. The king's from Scotland. Okay, set in Scotland.
Yes, I'll keep the king happy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is keeping the monarch happy a good idea when...
I would say so.
Probably, yeah.
Yes,
most of the time.
Yes, especially when he's paying your bills.
Keep your sources of funding and possibly your head intact.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So all that being said, and there being strong women in this play, the fifth act still doesn't feel necessary to me. So, you know, we read the play and we definitely see Shylock's plot line as the plot line. The thrust of this play is Shylock and the conflict around that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess you have to remember that this is a romantic comedy.
Yeah, and it has to have its resolution. People have to couple up at the end. And they have to go off and have sex.
So is that the English major's defense of why the fifth act has to be there?
Pretty much, yeah. It's genre. It's genre-based. You have to have this at the end.
Would it not have been okay to defy the convention and end at with the fourth act?
Well, Shakespeare defied the convention at one point. In an earlier play called Love's Labor Lost, it's supposed to be a romantic comedy, but they don't get married at the end, which has always been kind of interesting about the play because they go off and they have to do something else and maybe they'll get married at a later point. But generally, Shakespeare didn't break the convention. You know, just like a lot of how our, you know, television or some of our films are very formulaic. We expect a certain resolution. We expect a certain scene. It's very conventional. Same thing here. He had to have that fifth act in. That fifth act, there had to be a resolution.
And if Shylock's your protagonist after that scene, when you watch or read scene 5, I usually just sit there kind of stewing, like, you guys are all dicks and I'm mad at all of you. Please stop talking about your rings and how cute and clever you are.
Yeah, you just totally ruined a man's life for no reason.
And I usually blithely ignoring that.
And you're like, ring drama, derp.
Thank you for that. But I guess, you know, if, like Tony was saying, if Bassanio and Portia are the protagonists, and then if people viewed Shylock's conversion, if people view Shylock's conversion as a good thing, then they're kind of ending the play on like a oh-ho-ho-ho note.
Right.
Like, yay, we're reveling in their success.
Everything's happy. Hey, Antonio, remember how your livelihood got wiped out for no reason so that Shylock could try to exact his revenge? Well, guess what? Three of your ships are fine.
Woo!
You're now as wealthy as any merchant in Venice.
Yeah, and you don't have to give any of it to Shylock.
Yeah, in fact, half of his stuff is going to the state.
Even though if that trial had happened tomorrow, he would be getting it. What? Yeah, I agree with Ben. Mostly Act 5 just leaves me with a sour taste in my mouth. I guess I can sickly revel in the fact that Antonio still doesn't get to get married.
I guess put it in the category of when you're watching a movie that's formulaic and, okay, I understand. For some reason, the male protagonist has to have a girl to hook up with during the movie.
Right.
Even though if she was gone, it would subtract nothing from the plot. And in some movies, it would actually add to it. But it's in there because people expect it. Like, are people less likely to watch the movie if that's out of there? I don't know about that. But I mean, people do expect their conventions up to a certain point. And if you watch it, like, in a modern romantic comedy, if it didn't end with marital bliss or the prospect of marital bliss, people would be confused
and upset.
Romantic comedies actually love flashing forward to the wedding scene at the very end.
Everybody loves a wedding scene in a movie, apparently.
Right. Apparently. Watch them get married at the very beginning and like then slowly watch their marriage unravel throughout the movie.
Like the latest, like the latest Twilight movie.
Oh, no.
With a wedding scene that was longer than an actual wedding.
And the actual wedding being more horrible than...
And they had sex, what, twice during the honeymoon?
Like the...
Once because she cried.
The creepiest, most boring honeymoon ever.
I'm sorry, no.
All right, let's not get it down this road too far.
Back to the Merchant of Venice.
Shakespeare.
Okay. Thank God. We went to a dark place.
So why, or I guess the strengths and weaknesses of the writing, because one of the things English majors and teachers love to tell you is how beautiful these plays are and how great the verse is.
Yeah, so I guess the weakness of the writing in this case is the fifth act. But that aside, what about the actual verse within it? I've as much as said already that I'm just not that impressed by this play, honestly. Like, most of the wordplay in it, I wasn't that interested in. Like, I didn't think most of the jokes were very funny. And the landscapers from my apartment complex have come over because they found out we were at Gabby's place. But, like, what's the reason to read this play? Like, why is Shakespeare so... We're going to have to wait. That's fucking loud.
Seriously.
It's like they're on a schedule or something.
Well, we are, like, doing this way later then.
True.
Okay.
All right, so, like, what's the reason to read Shakespeare, to read The Merchant of Venice? Like, what is so good about the writing that I need to be aware of?
Well, if anything, besides it being just, okay, this is a historical artifact, this is a representative of its time, it's a way that we can understand Shakespeare's England. I think some of the real powerful parts to it is Shylock. I mean, if Shylock was not in this play, if we had somehow were able to abstract him out of it or make him a less developed character, I don't think this play would be as much studied or as read.
I would agree with that.
It would be one with some of his... This would be put with some of his less read or less studied works. You know?
Most of the best lines, in my opinion, go to Shylock. The ones that I remembered years later were all him.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, I mean, I think we read it for Shylock. We read it for Shylock also because... we want to talk about questions of prejudice, questions of anti-Semitism, and how those questions we still need to resolve and deal with. And so
this play specifically basically gives you lots of things you can teach.
Right, exactly. And also, and that's why we might want to still read it or why it's still relevant, but another thing is, it's better, I say this best, these plays are not meant to be read, they're meant to be performed.
Well, they're plays, I guess. Exactly. That makes sense, right?
And I personally, I don't like reading them as much as I'd like watching them being performed for me. And this is always one of the struggles in teaching Shakespeare, is that, you know, students do get bored. They get bored with the language, they get frustrated with the language, and the plots aren't moving. And it's hard to help them visualize, hey, look, okay, let's try to imagine what this would be like, you know, performed, and trying to get people up and performing it, or trying to show them some scenes from the play, that of a production of the play itself. I think that, you know, seeing these plays performed, yes, they are still really good. They're still really funny.
It is surprising when you're, especially when you're younger and you're reading a play and you're not used to Shakespeare and you get bored. And then you go and watch a live performance of a play. I remember when I saw A Midsummer Night's Dream when I was in middle school. I was laughing pretty much the entire time. Mm-hmm. Because you read something, you're just like, oh, whatever, they're saying boring words I can't understand. And then you hear someone actually saying them, you're like, oh, there are 10 jokes tucked in there.
Yeah, right. The actors can convey a lot of what the words are. Well, they're tough to understand, especially as a student.
Mm-hmm.
Rereading this play now, you know, 10 years plus after graduating from high school, I didn't have to go back and reread lines over and over again to figure out what was going on. And believe me, that made it a lot more enjoyable this time through. I've seen teachers do try, we've talked about this a little bit too. They'll try to get a little of that performance aspect in there. They'll try to have you read scenes, or some teachers will even do the whole play. Try to have the class kind of perform it.
Mm-hmm.
Though, even with that, like, especially in a high school class, a cold read of a Shakespeare play as a high school student. It's almost meaningless. Like, you're better off just reading it and then explaining every line of dialogue, I think, at
pretty
that point.
Much. Yeah.
And if you show student scenes, you have to be careful which productions you're showing, because I've seen movie productions of these plays before where they're produced in the most boring way possible, where you have two characters standing there and talking at each other. And like, I'm like, seriously?
Franco Zeffirelli.
This is a some of the BBC productions of the plays are not very good.
Yeah, some of them aren't very good. You have to be very careful about which productions you would show a class. Very, very careful. Not only for, you know, quality, but also for questions of nudity.
Occasionally, yes.
Yes, there's a film production of adaptation of Macbeth out there that was sponsored by Playboy. Tons of nudity.
Not surprisingly.
Tons of nudity.
Like, ooh, niches. Niches.
Niches.
Wicked dancing.
Nude niches. They're nude witches. Niches.
Witches. Naked dancing.
Yes. And there were tons.
I believe it.
But I think we can all agree that even if when you read the play you kind of get a little bored, you kind of have to remember, well, you go see a really good production, The Merchant of Venice, which is still produced in the modern day world. If you go see a really good production of Shakespeare, you actually usually don't notice the language.
That's absolutely true. Yeah, that's absolutely true.
It does not feel different, and you don't have to sit there and try really hard to interpret it.
Right.
Because the way the actors, good actors, perform it, it just happens.
Mm-hmm.
So, give some props there. So ultimately, Ben, verdict?
Verdict is I was mostly frustrated by this play. I don't know if I'd go as far as to say that I just disliked it openly, but I wanted more from certain aspects of it, and I didn't get that.
Fair enough.
Cool.
It's not my favorite Shakespeare play. I will say I think Shylock is a magnificent bastard. I love him. Like, in pretty much any time he talks, I'm just like, I would be like a Shylock flunky. Like, opposite Graciano, like, whatever, Christian.
Go eat your pork.
And that's the reason I really appreciate the play, is that aspect of it. So
cool.
But we thought one thing that we could do, just because most people do have to run into Shakespeare at some point in high school or in college, and because Tony and I have both read a lot of it, we thought we could throw out some maybe other recommendations for people if they're interested in Shakespeare, but maybe didn't love The Merchant of Venice, or maybe liked it enough that they might go out and read or watch something else.
Yeah, so Gabs is going to give us three plays that you could read if you were not as much into Shakespeare, and get you a good cross-section of some of the interesting stuff.
Good
so what,
survey, I guess.
What are your three survey plays here?
Well, I am always tempted to throw in comedies because I think it's easier for people to relate to comedies faster.
I tend to agree.
Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite plays is Twelfth Night. I think it's funny and has some really good issues in there. Twelfth Night actually has a little bit of The Merchant of Venice in it, where one of the characters practically makes it into a tragedy. But it still ultimately ends up as a comedy. There's cross-dressing and twins and all sorts of stuff. So I really like Twelfth Night. I think it's fun. And all those issues that are in Merchant of Venice are in there, except I just think it comes across more comically. For my tragedy, I recommend Othello, because I think people are so familiar with Hamlet that if you try to approach it as someone who doesn't know Shakespeare very well, it just comes across as a meaningless series of quotes. And the thing I like about Othello is there are a lot of issues in there that are important to people. Obviously, the interracial couple is the center of the play, so the race issue is a huge thing in Othello. But I also think Iago is
yes.
a fantastic villain. He is an excellent character. And the way he and Othello interact is awesome. So I definitely recommend Othello. And then I threw in another comedy. Ben and I both read Much Ado About Nothing in high school, and I know a lot of people who had to do that. And I threw that one in because it's a little shorter, it's a little easier, and Beatrice and Benedict are really fun. And I think for a more casual Shakespeare person, Much Ado About Nothing is one of the easiest plays to read and appreciate. So that's kind of why I put it on the list.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and then Tony, what would you...
Mine? I would say, number one, I'm going a little different, I'm going with one of the history plays, but it would be Richard III. Delicious bastard.
He is.
What's so great about that play and that character is he'll tell you, okay, look, I'm going to go do this. And then he goes and does it. And you get to see it, and you get to laugh with him, like you're on the inside of the joke. And he does horrible things, but you're with him, and you're rooting for him, and I love that.
Yeah.
And you should... If you do read that, I would say right after you're done, watch Looking for Richard. It's Al Pacino's documentary about how he's trying to make a film of Richard III, and it's just hilarious. So definitely that one. I would say... I like Titus Andronicus.
Andronicus?
Yes. That's one of my favorites because it's so bloody. It's so over the top. It's very representative of early Shakespeare. This is Shakespeare trying to learn his craft still. You know, this is one of the earliest plays out there. And there was
a lot of death,
a lot of bodily mutilation, and just everybody gets their comeuppance at the end, especially when they eat the pie.
I love to say, the famous pie scene.
The pie scene, yes. Serving you your sons.
Yeah.
It's really good. It's incredibly gory, but worthwhile. And there's a great film adaptation starring Anthony Hopkins. So pair those two up. And I guess the third...
eating people.
Yeah, I know. He does that a lot. And the third one, I would have to say... I like the Tempest. I always think they're hilarious characters. I think the play is so fantastical. I mean, a lot of people say this is early fantasy fic, or so I really liked it. I think it's a good one to read. And there's a recent film starring what's her name?
Oh, Helen Mirren.
Yeah, Helen Mirren.
Yep.
Yeah. So those three.
And if anyone's just interested in going and seeing a Shakespeare play, the Kansas City, if you were in Kansas City, I guess I should
That's
throw
where
that
we're
out
based
there.
Out of, yes. Just so you know.
If you are in Kansas City, they have a Shakespeare festival every summer. And this summer, they're actually doing two plays. On alternating nights, they do a play. So they're doing A Midsummer Night's Dream, which is really funny to watch performed. And it's free to go. And then they're also doing Antony and Cleopatra, which... some people, I think, could probably leave or take, depending on who you are. I would say if you're completely new to Shakespeare, go on the night when they're doing A Midsummer Night's Dream. But they always do a pretty good job, and you'd actually get to see the lines spoken instead of trying to read them on a page. So I'll give the Kansas City Shakespeare Festival a little
free plug there.
Yeah.
Very cool. Very cool.
All right. So I think that's everything we have to say about Shakespeare. For now.
Yeah, for now. Definitely for now. So we'll start getting out of here. So what are you reading right now?
I'm reading The Stand by Stephen King.
Me too.
Which is the longest book in the entire world.
There is so much of it.
Like, I will sit down for an hour and a half and go, I didn't even read 100 pages. The font is so tiny.
It's like 2-point font, 1,100 pages.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. That's definitely my big project. I did sit down and read a book called Just Listen by Sarah Dessen. You'll remember that I read a book by her a couple weeks ago. A recommendation by my friend Kim, and I actually read it in one day for the Semi-Charmed Life Summer Reading Challenge, which we might actually do a little post about.
Yeah, we'll definitely be talking about some books that we read for that as we go along. How about you, Tony? What are you reading?
I am reading right now Hanging Hill by Mo Hayder. It is a murder mystery that centers around sex trafficking and internet porn in Bath, England, which is kind of interesting. And I just got finished reading Rachel Maddow's Unmooring. So.
What was that about?
That was looking at how the rise of the military-industrial complex is starting from Reagan up through the current administration.
And we like Rachel Maddow.
And I kind of realized, my God, Reagan was really corrupt.
Oh, yeah?
Jesus.
If you've read Noam Chomsky,
I have. Yeah, I'm also reading his Hegemony or Survival.
Ah, okay.
So, yeah.
Yeah, he'll talk about that plenty, too.
Yeah.
So you want to go ahead and plug your website again before
that? Yeah.
Okay, if you are interested in seeing how the Renaissance matters still today, which it really, really does, go to my blog. It's called renaissancematters.com.
And it's fun. I like it. I read it. I subscribe.
Yeah,
I comment.
Yep.
There you go. Read about bacon.
Tasty, tasty
and
bacon.
And other pork products from 500 years ago.
Shylock wouldn't be allowed to read that blog.
That's right. Shylock would have to lose his trial before he'd be allowed to read the blog. anyway, if you have anything you need to say to us, or even want to say to us, or if you just like to talk in our direction, like we do, then you can leave a comment on our website, novelideaspodcast.com.
Or you can shoot us an email at novelideaspodcast@gmail.com.
Or you can hit us on Twitter at novelideaspod.
We are also on iTunes, so you can search for us there under podcasts.
Yeah, if you subscribe to us, I know a couple of you do. If you just found us there, then please leave a comment, rate us. Let us know what you thought. Also, let iTunes know.
Yeah. We love to hear anything, even if you are super angry at us right now. We'd love to hear it.
I assume there'll be one eventually.
Yeah. I know of someone. Probably when we do the Twilight podcast.
Yeah, probably.
I could post an angry comment if you want.
Love it.
I don't like Ben's shirt. I don't care if I can't see it.
So, that's what we got. And next week, we will be doing The Stand by Stephen King.
Yep. All 356 million pages of it. So, that's it for this week, and we will see you next time.